DBM category. By hook or by crook, by directional couplers, the right number of dBs of coupling factor, the right number of dBs of pads, somewhere in the system. And you got to be careful with a modern-day analyzer. So a person who really understands high dynamic range, high spectral purity measurements, the automatic functions of the modern-day spectrum analyzer will drive you up a wall. You will rapidly, if you have enough knowledge, start using some very strong, faulty language. You'll say those blankety-black engineers, they made the thing so GD idiot-proof that I can't do what the hell I'm trying to do. Here's what I'm talking about. Assume now I'm doing a two-tone test. Assume now that I've got two signals on the screen from two very clean signal generators combined with two very good hybrids, combined by way of two good circulators, so those two individual signals are really isolated. I have reason to believe that the instrumentation modulation distortion of my two signals are minus 100 dBc. If you're careful enough, you can definitely create that for two very good signal generators. Let me drop. And now you will plug those two signals into an amplifier under test where you're trying to do a intermodulation distortion test. And out comes your two tones and a whole great big Christmas tree of other stuff. Third order, fifth order, seventh order, ninth order intermodulation signals. But because you're testing an amplifier, and because the amplifier is amplifying those two signals, what's coming out is stronger than what you put in. So now you see a whole Christmas tree of stuff on the analyzer screen, and the first question you ask yourself is, hey, am I looking at what the amplifier is really doing, or am I looking at spectrum analyzer overload? The quickest way to find out the answer to that question, in the old days, before all this doggone automation, is you would turn the big knob on the front panel of the spectrum analyzer labeled RF attenuator, which had no other automatic function connected to it, you would plug in 10 more dB of attenuation. If it was set at minus 20 dB, you'd go to minus 30. You'd plug in really 10 dB of more attenuation. If the signals on the screen were really coming from the amplifier under test and not coming from the spectrum analyzer, every single signal on that screen would move down exactly 10.0 dB. If they moved any other number, you know that the analyzer was a contributing factor, because you only change the level of all of that jazz going into the analyzer by that beautiful broadband, very linear step attenuator. That's the way we used to do it. Nowadays, the analyzer tries to keep the screen completely calibrated at all times. You plug in, you punch the buttons on the front panel in such a way that you request 10 more decibels of RF attenuation, and the automatic functions are trying to keep the reference level at the top of the screen set at the exact same number. So therefore, the automation, when you plug in 10 dB of RF attenuation, is D turns on 10 more dB of IF gain out back in order to reset the screen back to the same reference level. So you're knocking down the signals of the RF attenuator. He's increasing the gain internally of the IF strip. Therefore, whatever intermod the analyzer was making just became brand new numbers, and no, you no longer have a valid test. And you'll start at a
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And as I said, you'll start using some very strong, salty language because the automatic functions will fight you. The only defense for that is that now you must plug in an external known good RF step attenuator, or you must plug in pads, and it's a pain in the neck test to unscrew the attenuator, you know, the type N connectors, the SMA connectors, whatever the heck they are, to unscrew them and to plug in external attenuators on the outside of the front panel of the analyzer to box that system to find out where the heck the intermods are coming from. Are they really coming from the amplifier with the test, or are they coming from that analyzer? So you have to fox the system externally, and it's a pain in the neck, and it's hard to do rapidly and get a good, clean answer like we used to. Again, this is a little bit more of the information you need to know in order to do the test you're trying to do, because measuring intermods X number of dB down on a two-tone test, or measuring noise side lobe on the side of a transmitter frequency synthesizer to measure spectral purity, there's a strong similarity in the test because immediately everything you do is suspect. Is it coming from the analyzer, or is it coming from the device on the test? And to separate fish from fowl in this situation, you've got to be darn careful, you've got to be knowing what you're doing. Otherwise, you can get some beautiful answers to three decimal places that have no meaning with reality. Again, I'm trying to give you a little more information as to what you're trying to do. You're in a somewhat difficult area, Joe, and it's not going to be quite as easy as you'd like. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, well, the analyzer is capable of, you know, like they said, in an automated fashion. If you change the span, for example, put it on a certain frequency and a certain span across the screen, you'll end up with a certain sweep time and a certain resolution bandwidth setting. You can manually change the sweep time or manually change your resolution bandwidth setting. If you change your resolution bandwidth setting to a lower number, the noise on the screen will obviously go down and it slows down the sweep speed because I guess it's got to, you know, run slower to be able to more accurately display what you actually have there. And you get to a certain point, if you try to exceed the parameters that it's internally calibrated for, it will tell you it's uncalibrated. So the measure you're making is out of meaning because it's fully out of the calibration range of the unit, what it's capable of. That's I'm just trying to find out if you can use the analyzer in this fashion, to be able to, take the right kind of measurements, and I don't think the analyzer overloads too terribly easy. And I'm not trying to do a two-tone test. I'm just simply trying to measure the carrier noise on each side of the carrier, like so many, a meg or half a meg away, or even 5 megs away. That's basically what I'm trying to do. But with all the things you're explaining to me, I just have to let it sink in a little better to get a little better understanding for it. So enough of this, I'll have to just study this some more. I have one other quick question, which I just, it's an HF question, which you'll probably love.
Yeah, on the previous question, Joe, you've only gotten two-thirds of the information you need, and as a typical normal human being, not all of it is going to make sense immediately. We're going to have to go over this a number of times over a number of weeks. Hopefully other people listening will tolerate some of this because it is a good thing to know. The total number of RF engineers, savvy RF engineers in the United States who really understand high spectral purity measurement techniques, and that's what you're into, or high accuracy two-tone intermodulation distortion testing. The total number of engineers that really understand that subject, unfortunately, is an extremely small percentage. It is not well taught in the schools. We're going to have to go over this a few times. Go ahead with your HF question, K2RIW.
Okay. An acquaintance of mine has a HF transceiver hooked to his amateur UHF repeater, so he can basically run the thing remotely. Okay. I was able to, listen in on his, I guess he had it set on a certain frequency, happened to be on 80 meters, I think it was like 3805. And I wanted to see how well I could hit the system for my HF transceiver at the house. I put the radio on CW, and of course it gave me a beep note when I transmitted out into an 80-meter dipole after using the antenna tune function of the radio. So I was able to hit his receiver, hit his transceiver at approximately 20 miles away. And again, gave a pretty good beep note, and I could move the frequency back and forth so I could tell it was definitely me that was doing it. It wasn't just something else out there. Now, I took the transceiver and operated on the same frequency, but switched the antennas and used the internal antenna tuner to tune that antenna. So the transceiver would think it saw a good, very good SWR as far as the transceiver was concerned. That antenna happened to be a vertical antenna that was more resonant or more constructed for, say, 15 megahertz to 30 megahertz, where being a 30 being at the higher end, it was definitely tuned better. But by going to that antenna and doing the same kind of test and transmitting, then the receiver at the other end would not hear me at all. It was like 30 to 40 dB drop in signal. Because when I tried to test with the 80-meter dipole, I could vary my power from 100 watts out down to about maybe a half a watt or a couple tenths of a watt by reducing the power level and carrier power. I could still hear myself at those levels. But yet when I went to the other antenna at full power, couldn't hear myself at all.
Okay, there's a missing piece of information here. 20 miles away, the reception is taking place. You're changing power up and down on, let's say, first the 80-meter dipole, and you're on 80 meters, and the signal was being heard or not being heard. I presume the guy 20 miles away is playing it back to you on a telephone. Is that how you were making the judgment first? Go ahead, Rich. Here we go. Joe.
No, because I told you what I was doing, but I guess you didn't listen to all the pieces. He has his HF transceiver hooked to his UHF repeater. I was able to listen to his UHF repeater. I hear the output of his HF transceiver, which is coupled into that radio system. So I could do something and actually hear his transceiver live as it was hearing me at the time. He wasn't relaying information back to me.
Okay, it was hooked to the repeater. Therefore, the repeater was serving as the telephone. It was feeding you back direct live information as to how his receiver, 20 miles away, was picking it up. But you were making the judgment as to what you heard coming back through the UHF system. Is that true?
That is correct.
Okay, now I understand that part. And that's a beautiful way to do a test. I mean, to have a guy on the other end says, yeah, I think I hear something, that's nowhere near as good as you hearing the tone directly. The guys who go on 10 gigahertz and they use the 144.260 megacycles as a talk-back frequency, and when they're lining up the antennas, they play it back through the 2-meter link, the 10 gig signal being listened to 100 miles away, and you aim your antenna up and down, left and right, switch the frequency up and down, change the power, do whatever you've got to do, and you hear what he is hearing, and you know when you're properly aimed. Particularly when one guy has got high power and the other guy has got low power, you want to make sure you start off with the antennas lined up, otherwise it'll never be a two-way QSO. So hearing the information directly with your own ears as you make the changes at the transmitter, beautiful technique, very smart way to go. You did that right. Now, when you flipped over from the 80-meter dipole, I think you said a 15 and 10-meter ground plane fed with the internal antenna tuner on 80 meters. If I heard that correctly, in other words, you're quite a few bands away, very short on the antenna, vertically polarized, and hoping the antenna tuner is properly still delivering the same number of watts to that antenna. Did I get that part correct as to the part that you did not hear? Back to you, Joe.
Yeah, the vertical antenna is called an Antron 99, and you can basically make this antenna resonate to about 15 to 20 megs up to about 30 or 40 megs by changing the length. I would specifically tailor it to favor 10 meters. But with the antenna tuner, I can get the VSWR as far as the transceiver is seeing or indicating on the front panel, I can get that indication to be, you know, just about non-existent, even at the low frequency. Like 80 meters, it would definitely handle that. Okay, so it wasn't out of the range of the antenna tuner. So as far as the transceiver is concerned, it was delivering full power into an extremely low return loss, being indicated on the front panel meter, or low SWR, very low SWR. So as far as I could tell, I was transmitting full power out on the same frequency, just with another antenna that was vertically polarized. Now, am I right in assuming that between vertical and horizontal on a direct path is about a 20 to 25 dB difference between polarities?
Yes and a no to that. Even though it's a 20-mile path and you'd like to believe it was direct line of sight, because of the amount of noise you've got on the 80-meter band, and I think all of this was 80 meters if I understand correctly, the majority of the signal that should be getting there may be an ionospheric reflection. Once you're going through the ionosphere, even on a short distance of 20 miles, whether or not the polarization is being preserved is definitely doubtful. You may transmit horizontal in one case and vertical in the other case, and you assume he's going to get the exact same polarization. He may not, because of Faraday rotation. So, what was that 20-mile propagation? I mean, if both of you were on top of a mountain and your binoculars, you could see each other, you know you've got definite line of sight. But on 80 meters, with down low antennas, and who knows what kind of buildings and whatever in between the two, if you're 20 miles apart, the direct line of sight is now questionable. Not on VHF, On VHF, you can tolerate extremely weak signals because the noise on 432 is a, you know, 1 dB of equivalent noise figure from the antenna looking at the horizon. An 80-meter antenna, really tuned to 80 meters, is seeing amount of noise that's equivalent to a 50 decibel noise figure. You may be getting the right level of signal by line of sight to the other guy 20 miles away, but because the noise on 80 meters from the atmosphere is 50 decibels above KTB, the equivalent of a 50 decibel noise figure, that beautiful signal that's getting there may be 10 dB below threshold, and you hear nothing. And only the ionospheric reflection, if you're getting it, is above threshold. You could be running into one of these situations. There's more to the story. If you take a look at the October, let me drop. If you take a look at the October issue of QSD magazine, the one that just arrived, and you look at the doctor is in, somebody asked an extremely similar question. He went to an antenna from A to B, and the B antenna had an extremely high VISWA, and they went through the calculation of what the VISWA was. They calculated 746 VISWA. They made a math error. The real VISWA was more than 3,000 to 1. And they came to the conclusion that 100 feet of RG8U coax in that environment, because of that extremely high VISWA and the extra loss of the cable, that even though you're transmitting 100 watts, only 1 watt gets to the antenna to be radiated because of extra feed line loss. I mean, under normal circumstances, a piece of RG8 cable on 80 meters has got what you and I would call an extremely low loss. But when you go to these wild situations where you've got monstrously high standing wave ratios, all of a sudden that loss becomes huge. And therefore, only a very small fraction of the power is being transmitted. So you've got a polarization error, you've got a huge impedance error. And my next question now is going to be, what kind of feed line and how many feet of it? And you want to read that doctor is in second entry or third entry into the October issue of QSD magazine, Joe. It's going to give you a lot more information on this one. And as I said, they indicated the trend of how bad it is, but they made a math error. It's a hell of a lot worse than they indicated, even though what they indicated is intolerable. So B2RYY, K2RYW.
I do have that issue at hand. I will have to read that. Didn't even take notes. I was really looking at a couple other things in there, but I will have to take note of that. But what the one thing you said about the high, extremely high standing wave ratio on the cable, increasing the loss, where, you know, 100 watts going in is 1 watt actually in the antenna, that seems to make more sense than anything else. Because, as I said, from the same antenna, the resonance antenna on 80 meters, which by itself without the antenna tuner, is probably about a 1.3, 1.4 VSWR at like 3850 or something like that. That's where it seems to be about the best. The antenna tool will help and make it bring it actually down to just about nothing. So as far as it's concerned, it works good. But the other thing you said about the other using the other antenna, because it, by itself, I think it's I don't even think the transceiver will even want to operate. It looks like just about infinity as far as the standing wave. I just tried it as just a goof to actually see what would happen. And now, from what you said, it seems to be piecing the horizontal to vertical difference in the antenna, plus the added insertion loss, probably would make more sense than anything else of why the signal didn't arrive back there where I could hear anything at all.
Yeah, on a quick break, Joe, how many feet of what kind of transmission line went to that 10-meter vertical antenna?
RG213. And I would estimate about maybe 70 feet. And a very similar length going over the other antenna. Maybe it's a little shorter going to my dipole roof. Maybe it's 50, 60 feet to the 80-meter dipole and about 70 feet to the 10-meter. They're located far apart from each other.
And one other question. The guy that was 20 miles away, what kind of an antenna was he used to receive you?
He is using an 80-meter dipole antenna.
KY with a comment.
Bell recognized. I'm going to go to him in a second. Okay, you had three errors. 60 feet of RG8U, a fierce VISWA, which you haven't yet quantified. And by the way, to quantify that VISWA is going to be difficult because the insertion loss of the cable is so high in that environment. So it's going to be very hard to quantify. You may have had over 1,000-to-1 standing wave ratio, very similar to the article. So cross-polarized, very little power to the antenna, huge amount of VSWR of the cable, lots of insertion loss. All of these are contributing, and a lot of noise in the band on 80 meters makes it very difficult. K2KEY, I wonder if you've ever done any experiments like that one, Mel. K2RAW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I've gotten a lot of this type of comments in the past. There were a lot of people that, for some reason, got too interested or, you know, went ahead and put together one of these little QRP radios. And for some reason, they also touted them onto what I would call QRP antennas, these little Wonder Whips and all. One of them that they were selling, it was a 48-inch whip that was supposed to be able to work quite well on 80 and 40 meters, and they were trying to show you that you could have this little QRP radio, put it in your pocket literally, and then have this little whip that you pull out and open up to the 48-inch, and that would suffice and get out with this QRP radio. And after a while, they gave up on the QRP radio, say this thing don't work. But when I took it, a number of these times, took the radio, and I showed them, I put it onto a real great antenna for 80 or 40 meters, and what the difference was, they say, oh, but why? And there's in what it was, you know, the rub, why? Let it drop. Okay, now another situation, in fact, I always tell them that I have an antenna here that works perfectly and all the frequencies, loads beautiful, no SWR, you can see, and yet it don't get out, and they say, well, why not? And I point to it, and I show them it's my antenna, my dummy load. So that SWR bit, you know, is not the whole criteria of the story, Dick, over.
Nope, there's a lot of changes in what Joe is doing there. Cross-polarization of horizontal versus vertical, ground plane antenna versus dipole, very different antenna pattern, not clearly defined line of sight, cross-polarized on the reception, extremely high VSWR that hasn't been quantified, and under normal circumstances, a piece of RG8U on 80 meters is very low and long. But when you start getting these standing wave ratios that approach 1,000 and above, standing wave ratio, all of a sudden what you think is the insertion loss of a cable goes out the window. It becomes huge. And this is a mistake I've made on a number of occasions. So a number of occasions I told the guy on the TechNet that don't worry at 80 meters about the VSWR of the cable. And various people would come back to me and say, well, I followed your advice and I didn't hear anything. I go over to open wire line and all of a sudden it works. Well, the open wire line, the 600 ohm open wire line, you got hugely lower loss on 80 meters than any piece of coax you can buy until all of a sudden it comes back into operation, a high VSWR antenna. So I've been forgetting about that extra factor. I knew it increased. I didn't think it would increase that much until I went through these set of calculations that that influenced me by the doctor is in issue October 2008 issue of QST magazine, where somebody asked a very similar question. So, good stuff, Joe. Looks like we're slowly getting smarter in these areas. That's the whole purpose of this net, to bring the clan together and find out what Mother Nature is telling us and how the physics of all this jazz works. I better go on to the next guy who signed in, which was Bill, if he's still with us, KC2 Tango Uniform X-ray, I think it is. Bill, I hope we didn't put you to sleep with all this. K2RAW in the tech net.
Can I get in here for a minute, please? WB2HWW.
Yeah, it looks like Bill is not there. I think that's the last person who had a question. Oh, no, we have Rich also, into EO. If you want to make a comment, Howie, go ahead. Howie, if you want to make a comment, go ahead.
Working. To get about the SWR, the bottom of that Antron 99 is a auto-type transformer matching. The center conductor goes to the center of the coil, the shield goes to the bottom. That, regardless of how you try to use an antenna tuner, that antenna is going to look like a dead short. No power is going to get to the radiating element. Remember that the Antron is an end-fed half-wave vertical, and that coil in the middle is basically your hot link goes to the center, your shield goes to the ground, the lip goes to the other end of the coil. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Howie. So you've given us a fourth factor as to what Joe was up against when he tried to make that work out of frequency range. Interesting. So that loading coil at the bottom of this halfway radiator was fighting him. The insertion loss of the coax was fighting him. The visual of the whole thing was fighting him. The cross-polarization was fighting him. Automatic was in good shape. And very little power was getting to the antenna. And with the fact that you just given us, maybe the answer was not even a watt getting to the antenna. Maybe it was milliwatts. We'll eventually find out. Rich, N2EO, are you still there? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Sure, I'm Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, N2EO. Dick wanted to, touch base with a question. Somebody had actually a comment from last week and then a question concerning vacuum tubes. Last week, somebody had emailed Mel and wanted to know what transconductance was, if you were going over that. And then you made a comment, and maybe I'm confused, but you said mu is equal to Gm, transconductance, divided by RL, the load resistance. And I don't know, it just sounded wrong to me. It probably is right, but, you know, I did this like 40 years ago in school, and I remember Gm, mu was Gm times RP. Times plate resistance, unless maybe I'm confused and it's mu equals Gm divided by RP and a power amplifier RP would equal RL, so it amounts to the same thing. Am I confused? Are we talking about the same thing or two different ways of coming up with mu, Dick?
Yeah, if I said Gm over RP, I said it backwards. Mu equals Gm times RP. I'm going to agree with you on that one. I may have said it backwards. A mu voltage gain characteristic is transconductance, Gm, times plate resistance. That tells you the voltage gain of the tube, voltage in, voltage out, even though the tube is acting in a transconductance manner. So you have to take transconductance multiplied by plate resistance. Call it load resistance if you like. And that gives you voltage gain if I've got that memorized correctly. So I possibly just straighten this out on that one, Rich. Back to you.
Okay, Dick. Well, I'm glad to know that. Well, in a power amplifier, RP would have to equal RL. So you would say Gm equals mu divided by RL. I think what you meant was mu equals Gm times RL, which is the same thing as RP. Am I correct?
I agree with that. If you're rating the voltage in at the grid, AC voltage in at the grid versus AC voltage out at the plate, then it's Gm of the tube under that operating condition times the total plate load resistance, RP, everything the plate of that tube sees in a resistance manner, whether it be loading of the Pi network or you got a bias loading resistor up to the B plus, whatever. The total resistance it sees multiplied by the transconductance, Gm, tells you mu, which is voltage gain, if I remember that correctly. So, nice to know once you study the load lines of these tubes, what they're capable of delivering. Are you using it correctly? Are you using it in the in the area where it's going to give you the best gain, the best dynamic range, the best intermodular distortion, which are not necessarily the same place. In general, when you overload these tubes, you get a little more linearity, even as the slight sacrifice in heat power output. There's nothing that'll start distortion of a linear amplifier faster than to be lightly loading so that it starts flat-topping on the modulating cycle of the RF that you're putting in. N2EO, K2RIW.
K2KEY.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, let me give you the exact relationship. GM is actually equal to the voltage change across the load divided by the load resistance times the volt change in signal, or the load, the load, as we called it, would be the GM times the R load times the V signal. That is the relationship between volt, load resistance, and signal change, Dick, over.
I agree with that. And if I take your left-hand side of the equation, voltage load divided by voltage signal, which is one of the factors on the right-hand side, divide left-hand side and right-side and hand side by voltage signal. By the way, with any of these equations, you're allowed to do any dividing, multiplying, whatever you want, usually, as long as you do the exact same thing on both sides of the equation, both sides of the equal sign. Usually it's legal. So if I divide both sides by voltage signal, on the left side I'll have voltage load over voltage signal, on the right side and hand side I'll have GM times RP, and I could redefine as voltage load over voltage signal as equal to mu, voltage gain. I wonder if that seems right, the way I rearrange your equation, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. That's basically another way to rearrange it. In fact, basically, if we look at it as R and E, we would just start with the basics. I think I may have gone over that using Ohm's law. And in fact, using it as the G for conductance, if we just take just plain conductance, the relationship would be G is equal to 1 over R, which equals to 1 over E. That is the basic relationship for conductance, Dick, over.
Okay. I'm gonna come at this from one other point of view. Most of us are somewhat familiar with Ohm's law. And Ohm's law has three different forms. E equals IR, I equals E over R, R equals E over I. I got that right. I think I got it right. Anyhow, E equals IR is the main one. In other words, the amount of voltage drop you're going to get on a resistor is equal to IR. That means it's the resistor in ohms times the current you're putting through the resistor. So, in the equation we just talked about, V load equals GM times R load times V signal. R load, make it equal to the R of the E equals IR equation. So, we know R. We want to know I. How do you rate I? Voltage signal times GM. Transconductance is equal to current flowing at the plate versus voltage you put at the grid. So the way of rating the current of your E equals IR equation, current is what you want to know, that's GM times voltage of signal. So there's a relationship here between this gain of a tube versus Ohm's law that we're familiar with. Wonder if that stuff makes some sense, Mel. Of all the equations that you've come up with and juggled around, I wonder if you've ever juggled that one like that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger. Yes, of course. I've juggled it so many different ways. So your basic relationship, like you said, if you use R, if we said that the ratio of voltage to current R, maybe if I can simplify this, is E over I. then the conductance is the reciprocal of resistance. That's how you get it. That is the how it goes from the R equals E over I. You take the, let me say it right. Let me see, let me get it right in my head. Then we have defined conductance as the reciprocal of the resistance. So conductance, being that little g, would then be equal to 1 over R, which would equal 1 over E. I think that's the best way to start understanding it, Dick. Over.
It might be. You've been wondering why my machine is suddenly sounding noisy tonight. Oh well. Maybe I'm getting a slight failure of this rig. I hope it's not going west on me. Let's see now. I think that's the main question you were asking, Rich. NQEO, KQLIW.
Yeah, that's correct, Dick. Takes me back to RCA Institute 40 years ago when I went to school. You know, all right. I had another question, Dick. Less esoteric question. I've been experimenting with different brands of tubes in some of the equipment that I own, vintage equipment, and I have found that there seems to be more consistency in the Sylvania tubes than any other brand that I've used, including RCA, TE, and some of the other. We're talking about new old stock, you know, stuff that was made a fair number of years ago when the specs on these tubes were not changed. And I was wondering, I know some of these tubes have industrial numbers. Like, for instance, I remember years ago, a 6BQ5 is equivalent to a industrial 7189. More like a 6146. That's a industrial number. These tubes that I'm buying, like we're talking about the 688, 688, these type 6AU6, 6U8, 6EA8, 6GN8. Are there industrial versions available? If I knew the numbers, that, you know, might have tighter specs, do a little better for me. Back to we are.
Don, good question. I wonder, Mel, if you've got an answer on that one. I don't think I do. A2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, let's go back. This is K2KEY. A lot of years. Let's go back to World War II. World War II, they went ahead and decided that they wanted ruggedized tubes. What is ruggedized tube really consist of? They went ahead and they did certain modifications, like to the base of the tubes. They supposedly used more exacting test procedures, and what they did, not to confuse them with consumer tubes, they went ahead and designated them usually with four numbers, a lot of them, like for instance, the one that really got most of the play during the World War II changeover was like an 807 that we always talk about, the famous 807, which basically was a 6L6, but they modified it, for instance, for military use and made it an 807. And what did they do with the 807? They took the plate lead from the bottom of the tube and they put it up on the top of the bottle and brought it through there. At the same time, they took, not to have the confusion, they took the 6L6 and they gave it a four-number designation so that there wouldn't be any confusion also in inventorying it. So in other words, all the tubes that were supposedly being used for the military wound up as an inventory using numbers. At according to some of the manufacturers later on, that they said these were more ruggedized versions, Dick, but I take that with a grain of salt, over.
One of my favorite tubes, though, Mel, the 4CX250B, there is a version called 4CX250R, which has a little bit more grid capacitance, a little bit more plate capacitance, because of extra support structures they put inside that tube. But boy, that tube could take a tremendous increase in mechanical vibration and survive. So in that particular case, ruggedization really meant something. But on the tubes you're talking about, I think you're saying the ruggedization, you're a little bit skeptical. I think you're saying sometimes it was advertising hyperbole and not necessarily a real redesign of the tube itself. Back to you, Mel.
All right. Each one of them came up with a gimmick. Like, for instance, did you ever hear of the Gold Bond version? They had a tube that were called Gold Bond. They had a Sylvania had one. What the heck did they call it? I forgot which one. I'm trying to remember now. That burn-in. They had tubes that were burned in. Others called it their gold gold line tube. I think that was RPA had a gold line of tube that they said were matched. How they would sell you, you know, a number of those tubes that were matched, like which I doubt very much if they were ahead. Yes, maybe the Alpha tubes they were matching, but I couldn't see how they you know, said that the consistency of the numbers that they were using would be matched in tubes such as like 12AU7 and the 6AU6s and 6AG5s and things of that sort. They started all that kind of nonsense, Dick, that I think was more hype than anything else. The only thing that you're talking about is when IMAC came up with ceramic tubes and had them designated for different services, whether they were going to be used for mobile services or fixed services, or for, they had three categories. One they had for mobile, the other one for fixed, and then they had another one for actually that they were using it in a different type of industrial heating system. And they modified the tube that's forgot what they called that, the different version, takeover.
Yeah, when it comes to match tubes, I think when it comes to the really serious audio files where they had push-pull audio output tubes, I vaguely remember there was something like a tube, a 5880, which I think was a rugged 6L6 type thing, and you could buy those in match sets. And a matched set of those tubes would supposedly give you less distortion and things like this. That's part of what we're talking about. I think Rich's original question, though, is that his experience is that he's happier with Sylvania tubes than any other brand. I wonder if you've heard of any of your group at the Kings County Radio Club making similar statements. Back to you, Mel.
I could say I take that with a grain of salt. The like for instance, Collins, for a great number of the tubes that they had in one run of Collins in the early versions, like the S lines and all the KWS series, they were, I looked in there, they were all RCA tubes originally. Somebody else said that they had a later model KWS1, and they had Tungstall tubes in there. Now you know something? I think, like I said, they went to the company, they got the best deal from, and those were the tubes that were purchased for that particular run of equipment. And I doubt if they tweaked anything at all, did any modifications and everything. In fact, back in those days, let's face it, you put the CD set, whether you use RCA, Sylvania, or whatever, I never saw any difference in the way the CD set played, Dick. Any of the, legitimate tubes played the same way. I'm sure you had the same experience, over.
Pretty much, although In the case of the parallel kilowatt amplifier, I once owned a pair of red Thermalox RCA brand 4CX250D2s. That's the ones that had the red ceramic. And boy, those tubes were hot. By hot, I mean, instead of 10 watts of drive, I could use about 5 watts of drive. The output power was higher, the efficiency was higher. Those tubes were really cooking compared to all other 4CX250B tubes of any other brand name I could get my hands on. Unfortunately, I hadn't yet discovered the safety factor of putting in a series resistor on the screen grid to make sure if anything goes wrong, where the screen voltage is present, the plate voltage is not present, but the drive is present, and all of a sudden the screen current goes sky high, with a series resistor of the right value, the screen is protected from over-dissipation, not allowed to exceed 12 watts. I didn't yet have that protection resistor in there. I made a mistake one day of turning on the drive. The plate voltage wasn't there, but the screen voltage was there. Didn't have the right interlocks and safeties and whatever. And I wiped out those two beautiful tubes in probably 4 seconds. Didn't know it. Burned up those screens like crazy. Never could find any more tubes like that. So there were some really hot tubes occasionally. A certain brand name, certain type, certain production runs and whatever. So I'm with you, Rich. I think there were times, not many, but there were times when there were tubes that really stood head and shoulders above all the others. And you seem to have found that periodically with Sylvania. I wonder, was it an output tube on your transmitter that you're talking about? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, in particular those 6AZ8s, not more gain necessarily, but more consistency. There's one particular tube in there I told you was you put a Phillips in there, you cannot zero the ALC meter. Another tube in the IF, also a 6AZ8, you can't zero the F meter. And I found little differences. Some differences with the RCAs, the GEs, they all work, but it seems like if you take a Sylvania and plug in another Sylvania, it's almost exactly zeroed from one tube to the other. Kind of a rudimentary way of checking the transconductance, I guess. You plug an RCA in or a GE and plug another one of those in, they seem to vary a little bit more. You can zero out the meter, but the consistency is not as good. And these are all brand new tubes in the box, brand new boxes from RCA, GE, Sylvania, etc. Bill, got a question for you. Years and years ago, I heard of a tube, a line of tubes that RCA produced. Never saw one. It was called Red Star. Have you ever heard of Red Star by RCA?
Roger, this is KTKEY. They had, for the audiophiles, as Dick was talking about, a lot of fancy tubes that they supposedly were broken in, they were supposedly selected, and they had them under the name of the Red Seal tube. And people, I guess some people have a hearing, they can hear the difference. But I remember, yes, that they, I can say they had a number of, I have never seen, yet when you start talking about alpha tubes, that was another story. Power amplifier tubes, specialized tubes. I'm talking about where you jump from, I'm talking about the run of the mill. Now, as far as the 6AZ8, good thing you mentioned it. I have the bulletin in front of me from the Collins, one of the Collins collectors. Place your hand on Z1, the 6AZ8, and the KWM2 IF amplifier. If the 6AZ8 runs extremely hot, there is a modification. The cathode, pin 3, you add a 10-ohm half-watt resistor. The reason is that the original 6AZ8 that they used, that the transconductance, like I said, the tube transconductance was somewhat lower because who knows where they got those tubes from. and it ran cooler, so that the tubes performed longer. So when you go ahead and put in so-called better tubes, I guess that starts to run hotter. So what they have done, Rich, they have made this modification, R75. On the schematic, it's marked R75. It's pin 3, the cathode, the V1. Put a 10-ohm resistor in the cathode, and it'll take care of the 6A Z8 headache you got there, over.
Yeah, let me ask you this one, Mel. The 6A Z8, the right one, was a semi-remote cutoff tube. That really means that a different amount of DC voltage, control grid voltage, bias voltage, gave a particular amount of plate conductance. And so when you get a tube that's hotter, I mean one that's going to conduct higher until you put more negative voltage on the grid, not semi-remote cutoff anymore, by putting in that 10-ohm resistor, you're getting a greater voltage drop from cathode to ground, which is doing the equivalent of putting a more negative voltage on the grid. Therefore, electronically, you're converting your particular 6EZ88 into something that acts more like remote cutoff. Is it possible that that's what's going on, and now not only does the tube run not so hot to the touch, but it also is brought back into the range where you stand a chance of balancing that S-meter? Is that what you think is going on here, Mel? N2EO, K2RIW? A question, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly, that's exactly what's happening. The tube, first of all, the shortening of the tube life, the S-meter is actually giving you the indication what's happening. The zero reading, the zero signal reading shifts about the scale, actually, by putting the tube in a tube tester. Basically, the S-meter being involved with this basically was telling you that is what was happening, Dick, over.
Okay, so this sounds like a recommended service note from Collins itself on changing R75, and where you have more availability of a particular brand of 6EAZ8, that except for the fact you can't balance the S-meter, maybe you're doing the job and they're running hot, I think you're not going to be affecting the resale value if you put in that 10-ohm, 1-watt resistor in the cathode, Rich. I think it's worth considering. And for a guy with your soldering skill, putting in that resistor and making it look almost as neat as the Collins technician did, even a guy doing a magnifying glass inspection of the rig on the inside, is still going to give you full dollars for it when you want to expel it. That's a guess on my part. N2EO, K2LIW.
Question for Mel, RSO.
Rich first, and then we'll go over to RSO. Go ahead, Rich.
All right, Dick, very good. You pick up WA2RSO. You know, right now I've got a Sylvania in there, and I noticed it's running, as Mel mentioned, running cooler, because that's exactly what it's doing. It's running cooler, the Sylvania. The Phillips were running hot, and burning out on me. Well, they weren't burning. What was happening was, I guess, it was going gassy or something. The meter would start to shift and change. You couldn't keep it zero. Now I've got a Sylvania in there, and it's running just fine. Fortunately, Mel, you may want to know, I found a source for the Sylvania tube. You're the one that led me on to the radio days. They've got plenty of 6AZ8s at Radio Days in Victor, New York. They're $8.50 a piece to 6AZ8s, and if you want to specify a particular brand, which I did, Sylvania, they're an extra dollar. So I bought four of them for $9.50 a piece, put them away, they're brand new in the Sylvania boxes. And, the new old stock, never used. You can see the flaps on the boxes are fresh. I did check them in the radio, and they all work fine. So for the time being, I solved my problem. But I thank you for that. I just want to know from Mel, where, if I wanted to use Red Star 2, how would I specify, where would I get, I guess, radio days, where they specify, for instance, a 688 or a 688 or a BNA in Red Star? How would I do that?
I don't know how they do it anymore, Rich. Really, I can't tell you for sure. I've been away from that for so long that I just recall it. The 6AZ8 was a specialized, let me tell you how it came about. Why did Colin pick up on the 6AZ8 of all two? The 6AZ8 actually was developed by Tungsol, and it was... the application was both in black and white and color TV receivers, basically. And the course of the pentode section of the tube had a very high transconductance, and the semi remote cutoff characteristics of the tube minimized the cross-modulation effect or overload distortion that you would maybe see in the picture of the IF station. So they went ahead and they adopted this tube. That's how Colin picked up on it and used it as their IF. Actually, I could say it was basically more or less in TV sets, more or less meant to be used as a video amplifier, if I remember correctly, an AGC amplifier, or actually in some industrial uses as a reactance tube. Now, adding this 75, this 10 ohm resistor, you have to look. It'll be some schematics. You'll see it having designated because the last of the KWM2, Colin did put it in, did put this resistor in and designated it R75. But if it isn't in there, you put it in there in on pin 3 of the cathode, Rich, over.
Okay, Mel, very good. I will probably do that tomorrow. By the way, talking about resistors, I think it's something new now. Radio Days is selling a kit. I think it's 500 resistors, half watt. Carbon composition resistors, which is good, because you want to keep carbon composition in the older gear, just to make it look right. Everything, virtually every value that was up to a mega ohm, I think went to a mega ohm, maybe above a mega ohm, from a few ohms right up. There's 500 resistors there for $99 now. So did you pick up RSO? And by the way, remember I told you what, TechNet, for some reason, he doesn't come up here all week, but the cat Jingles likes to come up here when I'm on the TechNet. I didn't see him, and I just leaned over the bed, and sure enough, he's here. Over to you, Dick. You got another fan, K2RIW. F2EO with Jingles on the side.
That Jingles is an intelligent cat. Boy, that cat goes to the head of the class. And I've been hearing stories today about people who listen to the TechNet in bed. And, oh boy, there's all kinds of ways of putting a spin or an interpretation on that. Hey, Frank, bring us back down to earth here. N2RSO, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RAW.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Mel, you briefly mentioned special tubes for audiophiles before. I seem to recall in my youth using tubes manufactured by the Mullard Company. I believe they came from Great Britain and they were prized possessions back in those days. I'm curious to know if are aware of them, and if you know if they're still in business, or have they been replaced by solid-state devices?
Then, tonight at 8 o'clock, welcome to the W2CA
repeater. Next time, complete.
B2HWW, what a comment.
Mel, that question was for Mel. Was that true, Frank?
Yeah, but...